Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this new journey and welcome to the conversation.
We really need to reflect and make explicit the contours of mourning and grief and really get them just as physical, you know, ritually, we can pay attention to those details. Digitally, we need something akin to that, where we start working out how can we maintain respect and dignity in these media.
My name is Pablo Andrés Ruiz-Salmones, and I will be your podcast host. Today's episode is a conversation with our expert Thomas Arnold, recorded in June 2025. In this podcast episode, we'll talk about how AI is affecting our relationship with death and with our loved ones who have passed away. We'll also delve into how our grieving process is changing and how that affects what, until today, seemed like a normal, if difficult, part of our lives.
Thomas Arnold is a research associate at the Human-Robot Interaction Lab at Tufts University and a lecturer in the university's computer science department. His work focuses on the ethical evaluation and design of AI systems for interactive contexts, including how moral norms will shape how social robots are judged. Thomas also holds a master's degree in theological studies from Harvard Divinity School and is nearing completion of his PhD dissertation. Thomas, thank you so much for joining us today. Again, it's a pleasure to have you here. And we'll be talking about a very interesting topic, which we covered also during our last salon, which is AI and grief. You know, AI recently has been, well, for the past months, I guess, even perhaps the last year, it's been shaping a lot about how people face different things in their life. Now it's also shaping how people face death. And that's certainly interesting topic to discuss. Before we go deep into that topic, Thomas, I wanted to ask you something, because I'm imagining that perhaps some people are wondering where the title comes from, which is Automation at the Gates of Weeping. Now, I know that comes from a very specific reference, so I don't know if you'd like to tell us a bit more about that to put us into some context.
The quote came from a line in an edited volume that one of my former professors, Kimberly Patton, helped to co-edit, called Holy Tears. And it's from the Babylonian Talmud, where there is a line that the gates of prayer are shut, but the gates of weeping are not closed. The co-edited volume is really about weeping and its role in the religious imagination across different traditions. Those of us that are familiar with Christian scripture understand the well-known shortest verse in the New Testament, Jesus wept. But the gates of weeping, I think, were interesting to me because it involved a social aspect of what grief, thinking about grief, not just as an individual interacting with an AI system, but thinking more socially and communally about what grief and its embodiment via weeping and specifically tears, how to keep that in mind in a largely textual screen-based interface, what tears are for ourselves and each other. So that was my somewhat cryptic use of the phrase. I pardon for being that cryptic, but for me it's a flag in the ground to say that how we think about grief, to me, is important preparation before we ever think about how we would evaluate AI systems for how well they comfort, how badly they comfort. If we're not comforting ourselves, if we're not in touch with our own grief and the grief of others, then we're already in bad shape, to me, before we start thinking about AI.
I agree 100%. And you just reminded me of something that I have a friend in the US who normally says that technology has the benefit of approaching us to people who are very, very far away from us. But it has the bad thing of, you know, leading us further apart of people who are next to us, right? So we don't talk to people who are right next to us, but we talk to people all over the world. And right now, it seems we can also now talk with people who are far beyond this world, according at least to what AI is doing. But I agree 100% with you. You know, we need to be in touch with each other's grief. And before we go deep into the AI question of this, how do you see grief evolving, Thomas, overall throughout this digital age, irrespective of AI, you know, like, but throughout the different technological advancements that there's been in the last 20, 30, 40 years or something? Do you see grief is changing among people, like the way they express grief with each other and precisely the way they are in touch with other people? How do you, as a society, how do we arrive to this digital and to this AI age under which concept of grief?
I mean, I think it's a great question to, at the very first, just admit I'm sociologically not an expert enough to make anything authoritative. I will recommend one book by the anthropologist Tamara Neese called Death Glitch, which is useful in looking at the internet and social media, taking us back a few decades at least. So not so much AI, but really digital existence. What the grief process in relationship to people that one has lost, especially those that you've really only known online and that you may not have met in real life. It's demanded a number of questions, just again, apart from AI, but just things about computing and data, how you memorialize someone. Is it disrespectful to keep their Facebook account open? Is it disrespectful to close it? And who decides that? I'm sure I'm not alone in having good friends that have passed away whose Facebook account or Twitter account is still active. And just the uncanny feeling of how you stand in relationship to that. I will say part of what interests me about tears and why I'm interested in the physicality of grief is because as I say on Zoom here, we do have a different interface where on one level, we are able to reach out and connect in ways that we might even prefer if we don't want to use a lot of fuel to take planes places. But then our physical space with each other of knowing how to approach or recede, to give someone space or to acknowledge them, maybe with a hand on the arm or some other physical gesture to accompany grief. I think we are in a state that, if we are thinking about sociology, Anthony Giddens, I think, talks a lot about modernity as being this throwing space and time into this flux where our sense of time is kind of disarranged and our sense of space as well. So I would point first to how we share space and what changes that's undergoing, because that to me precedes or helps fill out, before we even talk about AI, this larger kind of ecology of digital interaction.
A couple of months ago, a very dear friend of mine passed away. She was actually a very famous woman here in Mexico. She passed away recently. And I was just, I'd been just at her home having a conversation with her a month before, actually not a month, I think 2-3 weeks before she passed away. And I must confess, it was very weird to see her online after she passed away, right? Like on her Instagram account and her Facebook account, it was very weird to suddenly see her online. In that sense, you know, I get what you're saying about the physicality of it, but then at the same time, if you will, our digital twins or our digital beings, you know, that we have out there, it also affects you, right? Like, particularly when you have contact with these people throughout very much on a digital world. It's interesting how, even though they're not physically there, that the idea of seeing them there does throw you, you know, like a, it does hit you in one way or another. And you feel also kind of like a physical reaction to seeing someone online, someone who has already passed away, not even related to the AI, just to AI. So just as you were saying on social media, for example. In that respect, Thomas, I'd like to ask you a couple of questions there. The first one is, you just touched on something very interesting, which is who has the right to continue doing that? Who has the right to continue updating their profiles? And I want to ask you about your thoughts on that, if you think there is an answer to that question, or if it's more just like a hypothetical question, because the people who passed away, they're just simply not there. Should we ask the question of if someone has the right to continue, you know, with the digital preservation, if you will, of the person who just passed away?
Yes, I would again refer folks to Tamar Niess's Death Glitch that has a number of interesting discussions there, because it's a very complicated question around what rights language and the idea of digital wills and being able to foresee what will be done with one's digital existence, that we need to be anticipating that rather than trying to decide after the fact, as is often the case with technologies. Once you're deciding after the fact, you're really scrambling and coming up with some imperfect solutions. I would also refer to one of our attendees here, David Zvi Kalman's recent article last week on grief bots. That article raises some of these related questions around dignity and setting out some types of principles by which we don't, you know, intervene or cross certain lines where one is no longer respecting a person's authorship. And then we have AI and Faith, you know, our own Muhammad Ahmad, who's wrote in Three Quarks Daily about chatbot that he created of his deceased father and his interactions with that system, and how making up memories, what he calls a confabulation machine, raises a number of issues that, you know, legally I think will be pretty treacherous in terms of do you have the right to remake memories or remake what a person was or who they were, what kind of language they spoke. I think at this point, we really just need to get the questions explicitly on the table and concrete enough that we don't apply a broad brush principle when we haven't thought about the difference between something that I design that's on my computer versus a social media account that's publicly accessible and represents a different type of memorial. And here, I think we need to think about the history of war memorials, you know, debates in World War I about what kinds of things you could say about the child that you just lost in the war. How much anger could you put on the memorial? How much anti-government things could you put on a memorial? That part isn't new. Just as funerary masks and funerary portraits from millennia ago probably had the same evocations of the deceased, where you thought, ooh, that looks too much like them. That's almost as if we're trying to revive them or represent them to such a degree that are we being, you know, have we crossed a line in some way? And in the Gospel of John, we know that it's Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead that crosses a certain line and sets into motion his crucifixion. So, you know, I think we are on this territory where we really need to reflect and make explicit the contours of mourning and grief, and really get them just as physical, you know, ritually, we can pay attention to those details. Digitally, we need something akin to that, where we start working out how can we maintain respect and dignity in these media.
It's very complicated, because you also have, for example, as in the case of my friend, she was a public figure, right? So then that adds kind of like an extra layer of difficulty to everything, because public personalities have not only a, you know, of course they have their immediate families, but they've also have, if you will, an image or people have an idea of who they were, you know, based on what they saw on TV, social media or anything. So that I think adds an extra layer of difficulty, because what you were saying about portraits and all that, you hit a very interesting point there, because in the end, I think that we've always, in one way or another, we've always tried to preserve the memories of our loved ones through different objects, right? Or through different means, be it through portraits or be it through video tapes or anything, right? And what I think is that that poses in front of us, not just because you mentioned, have we crossed a line? But it's very interesting because I think that precisely because it's something that we've always done in one way or another, you know, through the means that we have available at our hands, it's not such a clear line, is it? I think it's kind of like a gray line, which just becomes grayer and grayer, if you will, but it's not, you know, it's not a binary thing. And I, however, do believe that perhaps our expectations have changed in that sense, or the expectations of many people have changed, because just a few years back, perhaps no one would have expected that you would be able to talk to the someone you loved after they passed away. Perhaps in the same way that no one ever expected that you would be able to see someone after they passed away, but then someone invented photography and, you know, you now you can see someone, if you will, or a portrait of them after they've passed away. At some point, perhaps that was unthinkable. You're mentioning, have we crossed a line? But where do you see that line? Do you see that line in remaking, perhaps, or reshaping these memories? I know there is a legal perspective, but from a more personal perspective, if you will, talking from grief, where do you see that line that perhaps we have crossed?
Right. Yeah. I mean, this is where I think the interesting work has to come, because to take a certain detour, I do believe that the data-centric conception or practice of AI, where inaccuracies or violations of various kinds are thought of as just material to optimize and to correct by better data, that starts to fall apart when you think about, to me, loss and mourning and the irrevocable nature of some actions. An officiant to a funeral who says, yeah, let me borrow your chatbot of your loved one and let me talk to it this evening. And then tomorrow I will give a more informed eulogy. You can't really iterate on that. If you say, yeah, you missed four or five crucial things about them, but we'll give you more data and then you can try tomorrow. That's not really going to work. We have certain things are one time and one time only. And we can think about life itself, according to certain metaphysical views, as being like that. But at whose expense are things optimized or corrected? And who's going to do that work? That, to me, is where I start to think about, okay, where are the lines? And there's a particular line in Muhammad's article about his deceased father and how he thinks of the chatbot, where he talks about co-authoring. And I liked that word because, as he points out, it starts to turn the conversation from, is this a proper simulation or is it deceptive? Is it manipulative? Are you trying to pass off this as a living person? Which brings in all the ideas of counterfeiting and almost deception that, you know, is baked into things like the Turing test and that don't really work as the reigning model, where again the idea is, well, if we can just simulate better and better and better and better, that doesn't seem to be as relevant as what he calls co-authoring, which is to say, if a loved one of mine would be someone that I would want to create this type of system for, I think it would be more healthy for me to think of it as a co-creation, as me trying to create a portrait of them with all the risks of that and the containment that would need to have in terms of my relationship to it. It's only when I then present it to the rest of my extended family of, oh, this will help your process of grieving, this will substitute, then I incur a lot more, to me, ethical burden, and I risk crossing a lot more lines. Whereas if I have a conception of this is a co-creation with where I'm putting in part of myself and my history and my flaws, my skewed perspective, my sibling may have a whole different view, my children might have a different view, then I can at least keep the responsibility of myself before me. And I think that that is in so many of these discussions as to what digital representations and simulations and recreations are, I think putting that at the fore at all times, that we are responsible and creating part of what these artifacts are doing. And we can't prescind from that and pretend that the technology absolves or somehow reaches a level of independence that we start to identify it as a property of the AI system. That, I think, is when you start to, you know, cross more lines in terms of letting it operate independently as an interactant or as an agent. And that's where I think we need a lot more anticipatory reflection about how not to implement things that way.
Yeah, no, it's a very interesting point that you're making. I agree, I think, with what you're saying, but I want to kind of like go a bit deeper onto this debate because, you know, I was talking about, for example, public figures, right? You can see that when someone who's very well known passes away, not only their immediate family, but everyone else also, you know, has a reaction, a very strong reaction to that someone passing away. You can see a lot of people crying. You can see, as you're saying, very many tears, you know, when someone who's represented perhaps many things to many people, you know, suddenly is no longer in this world. And talking about precisely about these lines, also when someone who's very well known passes away, it's just you have, you know, in my case, for example, many people from different TV channels called me to see if I wanted to talk about my friend. And I said, no, I don't think it's right for me to do it. You know, I just don't think it's right for me. I was a good friend of hers, but it's not, I think it's not on me to kind of like precisely put a portrait of how she was and who she was. I think that's up to her immediate family. But what I'm trying to say is that, don't you think that perhaps, and nonetheless, irrespective of these boundaries that we may think, like in my case, saying I'm not going to talk about this, or as you're saying that we still need to be responsible for all this. But don't you think that those boundaries will be crossed in one way or another? What I'm saying is, I didn't give the interview, but I'm sure many other people did. What I'm saying is, when someone passes away, everyone walks away with an opinion of them. You know, everyone walks away with a memory of them, and everyone has certain information on them. And that person is no longer here. So some of us, as you were saying, I think you identify these lines that we're crossing. But my question is, how can you take that debate, if you will, to everyone, right? Because the person is no longer there. So their immediate family, their friends, everyone's going to have an idea on that. This debate that we're having on a moment of grief, you know, after someone has passed away, where no one really knows what to do, because there is such a pain that, you know, it's just very hard to think clearly. How do you think we could move this forward, or how do you think it will move forward, considering those very difficult situations that people go through when someone passes away, that perhaps those boundaries are not as clear?
I think it's a really interesting illustration of why the public nature, an oddly public nature, of things like online memorials or online expression of grief and mourning and loss requires something that, you know, sits at an intersection of cultural norm versus best practices for a tech company that's has a platform or hosts some of this media versus legal regulation. Government, you know, policy and regulation. To me, it sits uncomfortably within those three. And I will say that I think the cultural norm piece for us at AI and Faith is something that we can really help to convene some discussions about. Is it something that we can control? Well, through what type of appeal, you know, I think is the question. And like you said, you can't have this type of ethical discussion distributed as widely as we might like and reach everyone with a certain set of questions of, before you post, think about, you know, these questions. People will fill that vacuum. As you said, you can personally say, I don't want to go there, but that really is not going to stop some other people. We need something more of a mediating where enough people can appeal to an example or a precedent or norm and say, that's not cool. This is how it's been done. This is kind of the understanding here. And, you know, I was thinking of the philosopher Helen de Cruz, who passed away last week, who, you know, affected a lot of people's lives as a kind of public philosopher. And I've been grieving Helen's death without having met them in person. So what is my place in relation to Pellin? Well, it has to be worked out. And I've been looking at other folks, philosophers, and others to kind of see what kinds of things have they been saying. And I think there has been an effort to try to negotiate a certain line with, you know, saying too much, trying to put a marker down of acknowledgement for how much Pellin meant without trying to engage in some of the more toxic dynamics of, I knew this person better than you, you know, and the kind of one-upsmanship that often happens in social media and otherwise, where these things of social status start to take effect. And I'm sure with your friend, there's probably that same dynamic of people maybe wanting to elevate their own status. So the relationship between memory and grief, I think, it requires, you know, so much attention. And it's something that, for me, thinking about memory care and those whose memory is on the decline or experiencing a severe loss, how does one think about a person who has forgotten their spouse passed away, that they are suffering dementia and they've forgotten their spouse passed away? Do you remind them of that and provoke grief? On what basis do you do that? That takes us a little bit afield from your original point, but I do think that grief and memory have these twists and turns that turn quite ethically loaded. Once you play them out, you can quickly see the need to address them directly.
I mean, people use, again, photographs or any other thing it's just a means to an end, right? In the sense that perhaps, for example, here in Mexico, during the Day of the Dead, where the food that people liked while they were here, and, you know, the tradition is that people come after or during the Day of the Death and eat that food. They, you know, come and visit the living ones. And then you put photographs of them as well. There's different just ways of preserving people. And in the end, it's just, I guess it helps you, because it certainly, I'm pretty sure, I mean, it's a beautiful tradition, the one that we've got here, but I'm pretty sure it doesn't help those who have already passed away. But it does help you, right? It does help the people, those of us who are still here, to remember our loved one. What do you think, or what sort of condition do you think it's being solved by AI? What sort of comfort do you think AI is giving us that perhaps other forms of comfort, like the ones we've discussed, were not giving us before? It's a big question, but in the end, what I'm saying is people are using it for, you know, because of something, because perhaps it makes them feel closer to their loved ones. I don't know. But so what's your take on that?
We even in ourselves, put AI to the side, I don't think we know the problem of grief. I mean, I think that's part of why it's so interesting to look at different religious traditions that talk about the Holy Tears volume. You know, there's a number of different religious traditions around the world, you know, looking at these relationships between sincerity, insincerity, which I think is a huge issue for thinking about online life, thinking about AI, and why I think tears is just an important point to anchor discussions of grief, because it's this indication of how close, for example, suffering and joy are, that the tears of mourning and loss are very close to the tears of deep joy and appreciation. And those can even turn into one another quickly if you are with a person who, say, loved the same person, and you're appreciating your connection with in memory and commemorating something that you share. And so what AI is addressing, I think, is itself, maybe I would say, kind of on a meta level, something that may be needing to be grieved, that there's a certain grieving that may need to be done, that we even use AI, that we don't have, that I can't zip to Mexico right now and commune and accompany in the way that I might like, that loss and separation may mean resorting to these tools. And I think, again, we have to shuttle back and forth between what's really new and then what continues. And I think a lot about ancient Greece and ritual lamentation and the professional lamenters, you know, that had maybe no personal connection with the person that has died, but are there at the funeral to almost help teach people and to help provide a kind of cathartic lamentation, you know, expression. And they do it really well. And that's the reason that they're there. And they provide kind of guidance. That is why, to me, when I think about AI as a kind of technological accompaniment or technological guide, I have a lot of questions about, well, I can see modeling perhaps language or maybe through a video of gestures, maybe taking some modeling from that. But I think we get back into, you know, what, how suffering really is part of our cognition and what intelligence, how suffering sits as a base layer for what might emerge as intelligence. And if you don't have that suffering layer, what are you actually representing? And I don't have a neat and tidy answer to that, but I just don't want suffering to be lost as a concept and as a relationship to our own bodies before we get enthralled with a technology that is really cool and does do some cool things and can achieve some automated tasks and even planning, you know, is able to perform these feats. But on what framework are we evaluating it is something I keep coming back to. So I have no doubt that like every other technology, people will find a use. People will find creative ways to employ LLMs and other forms of AI in ways that we probably can't anticipate. And ones that in retrospect, we go, oh, all the sci-fi, you know, Black Mirror episodes, they didn't foresee that you could use it in a certain lateral way where you don't get into the, you know, misrepresentation or deception. But I don't see it yet. I don't see that quite yet. And that, you know, may be me being lagging behind too much, but I would say that there will be some use cases that probably are surprising and that accompany in ways that don't try to reproduce physical accompaniment, but that provide, you know, some type of reflection and some type of relationship with loss that a person could say that was useful and that was helpful. And I feel more alive and feel ready to bear. I'm thinking of the book on grief that says how to carry what cannot be fixed. And I think that's a better measure. AI is not going to fix it. Can AI help one carry what cannot be fixed? Possibly. But I just want to be sure we're carrying the right thing.
Just as we mentioned earlier that, you know, at some point there were no photographies or anything, and suddenly you could see people who were no longer there with you and kind of like preserve a memory of them. I imagine that had a psychological effect to some degree. And I'm imagining that being able to preserve the memories of people in a different way, as we were discussing, might also have a psychological effect on how people face these difficult situations. First, I don't know if you're familiar perhaps with a study that may show different psychological effects on the same. And if not, I don't know if you've seen that some people that have used it and how they've used it, how they approached it.
It's certainly part of the literature that I need to revisit. I know that there are some studies that are coming out around some of the more recent chatbots. There's one I think that should be coming out next week, specifically around AI chatbots. I know that there is more work on spiritual care that is, you know, looking at community online, what kinds of spiritual care might be there that I think will be kind of an interesting point of comparison. But from the experience that I have in human robot interaction, I would say that we've known for a long, long time how easy it is to get a person emotionally engaged with pretty basic expressions from a robot doing a rudimentary form of crying to, yeah, verbal reports of apologies, admissions of fallibility, that you can generate trust, you can generate connection, you can generate vicarious pain through those simulations. So I think when you add some of the complexity of LLMs and how they will linguistically be able to, already are able to reach a level of detail, I think it's very easy to predict what we're already seeing kind of in mainstream journalism about spiritual chatbots and relationships with chatbots. That's quite predictable for folks in human-computer interaction and human-robot interaction, just because our social instincts are almost primed to be triggered and activated. So that to me isn't a very high bar. It's then how does the relationship develop? Where are the challenges? Where is the conflict? Where is the ability to learn something different or to have the roles of what are you doing? Or, you know, severe challenge. The idea of optimizing or contouring it to my preferences, I think is pretty disastrous. When you think about social function of our conversation here, of having, you know, some challenging questions to wrestle with and to pause to say, what am I doing? What are we doing with each other? What does it mean to be living a life? And so that's where I think we do need to be setting bars for what is presented as a product.
First of all, Thomas, thank you so much for this. I think it was an incredible conversation, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and your knowledge with us.
And thank you so much, Pablo.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. Stay tuned to listen to more recordings and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share with your friends. Don't forget to follow us on our social media as well. We're on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us today.